So, hello again, and here we are again with the One Shot Football podcast from Singapore. I'm your host, Steve McBain, and you can get all your latest football news and views, tactical analysis and reports at www.oneshotfootball.com. So, as I say, we're here to again today in Singapore. We're at a District 10 restaurant, owned and chefed by Luca Bezerra, so give them a try if you're in Singapore. Now we're back up to a full complement of four this week after dropping down to three this week, and they're all new guests. So I'd like to say a big welcome to Chris Paxton,
hello,
and to Michael Bell,
hello,
and to Rick Overton.
Good afternoon.
Now then, one of the things that we do for all our new would-be pundits is to ask them who they support and why. Now we've got two Manchester United fans, so we take it as read that you know they're just rampant glory hunters. But Chris, can you come up with another credible reason as to why you support Manchester United?
I first started watching football in the 1980s, and they had a beautiful kit back then. And
is that the one with the Sharp logo on the front?
The Sharp logo and the white stripes down the front, and that just got me. And ever since then, I've been a crazy Man United fan.
So you're in football for the fashion then?
Exactly.
Okay, now Rick, you're also a Manchester United fan?
Yes, I am. I'm a Man United fan because my family is from Manchester. I was actually born and raised for my first 13 years in Manchester.
I thought it was Bolton.
No, the hospital I was conceived at was Bolton because the Manchester hospital was probably full. Now, I didn't really have a choice in who I supported. My father was a big Man U fan, my grandfather was a big Man U fan, and I didn't really have a choice, but to be honest, it's been a brilliant choice.
Well, as I said, Bolton or Manchester United, a rampant glory hunter. Now, Mike, you, like myself, are a Chelsea fan. Can I ask you why?
Well, I was a season ticket holder from the year that Mr. Mourinho took over for about 4 years. I had four seats on the very back of the Upper East, despite the fact that my dad's from Manchester and grew up in near Bolton, actually, and then Crewe. I managed to get a little bit rebellious and lean the other way as we lived in London.
Excellent. Well, there you go. And one of the things I'd just like to reassure everyone is, despite the plethora of North American accents that you hear today, this is actually a football podcast with round footballs, none of that egg-chasing stuff. Now, Chris, just quickly, favourite Manchester United player? Of all time?
There's only one player, it's Cantona for me.
Cantona. Rick?
Paul Scholes.
I think that is like probably the hipster's choice. And for you, Mike, Chelsea?
Petr Cech.
There you go. Another hipster choice, I would suggest. Now, in part one, we're going to have a look through the week's news. And the big story has, of course, been the fallout from the Diego Costa incident with Arsenal. I mean, what do we all think on this? I mean, what happened? Is this all handbags? I mean, or something a bit more sinister, Chris? Or...
I think there's two points to look at here. First is on the pitch, did Diego Costa do anything wrong? And then the second point is why was it referred to the tribunal afterwards for retroactive punishment?
Presumably because of gamesmanship from Wenger in getting it brought attention to, no?
Well, perhaps that's the case. Is that wrong? Is that worse than what Diego Costa did? I don't know. But for me, if we look at the first point about what he actually did on the pitch. He got the three-match ban for two actions, I believe. First was the left-hand side push with two arms, and then was the right arm elbow into the face.
I wish we had a webcam, by the way, because Chris is doing some wonderful reenactments here.
And to be honest, I think it's a very tough call to make because you can't tell his intent. To me, it looked like he did it on purpose, and he knew there was someone behind him. So personally, I think. Although it looked like he was guilty, I think the intent can't be proved, so I think he's been very harshly judged for the three-match ban on this occasion.
And what about the Gabriel Paulista has been overturned? We all think that's fair or unfair. I think it's grossly unfair, but...
I think that's completely out of order. I don't understand why that's been overturned. He reacted. He shouldn't have reacted. And I think it set a dangerous precedent going forward. And I have to agree with Mourinho on this one occasion.
I mean, by the letter of the law, I mean, if you raise your hands or, you know, any of these things that we saw on the pitch that transpired, I mean, yes, these are red cards or yellow cards or whatever, but, I mean, surely football is a contact sport and it's a man's game. I mean...
Well, it's not football, really. I mean, I'm a fan, and I want to see football played. It was a classic game, a very intense, very important game, and it was determined by a certain incident and took away from the football play. Once Arsenal went down to 10 men, you know, the game was almost over. And then certainly when Santi Cazorla went off, I mean, it was pretty much done. So it took away from what we actually want to see is football. And, you know...
But again, is this not with the... I mean, if the referee there, I mean, could he have not just turned round to the two players, you know, in the centre circle where this happened and said, you know, look, guys, I've been watching this, that's enough, any more, and you're both off.
I think that would have been the right way forward. Keep the game going. Get everything, you know, keep the game moving along. Keep everybody entertaining the fans. Give both of them a stern talking to in the middle. Say, no more of this. Next time there's going to be some punishment. And the game would have moved along and everybody would have been much happier. I'm sure that, you know, they were both acting, they were both pushing around a little bit. That's quite normal. But, you know, giving 3 match bans to anybody for what went on there, I think is a little bit extreme, to be honest.
Well, and the upshot of it is that both teams are left feeling aggrieved. Obviously, Wenger is unhappy at losing the 3 points, and Chelsea unhappy at losing Costa for 3 games. Now, moving on to Liverpool, Brendan Rodgers is most certainly under pressure. They had a tepid draw at home to Norwich, and then drew with Carlisle over 120 minutes, despite having, I think it was 47 shots on goal. But, I mean, all shots from distance and shots going wide. I mean, I thought it was very telling as well that Gary McAllister did the post-match conference and said that they were delighted. I mean, I don't know what possible reason they could have to be delighted. I mean, is Rodgers on borrowed time now? Or?
I mean, you have to look at what happened. I think with regard to Rodgers, you look at what happened at Liverpool recently, the fact that he was sort of given a second lease of life this year after perhaps a difficult year last year. But then you have to look at ultimately Fenway Sports Group and how they've treated people in the U.S. when the Red Sox were failing. They give them a little bit of a chance, but when it comes down to it, they're fairly abrupt and brutal about getting rid of bad managers when they think they've got the correct players in place. So I think if he has a bit of a rough run from here out, he's probably gone for now.
I think the players are, you know, partly to blame here. I mean, I watched the Norwich game, and Liverpool did play much better than they certainly did the week before against United. I mean, I think they've been dreadful all season, and I think they're starting to show some signs, but they're not putting the ball in the net. And I mean, Brendan Rodgers has got to be, you know, accountable for some of this, but I do think they definitely playing better. But the thing is you need to get wins, you need to get points, you need to make.
I think, Chris, one of the things I wanted to ask was, I think there seems to be a general agreement that it's transfer by consensus at Liverpool. There's this transfer committee, and also, you know, Rodgers' net spend isn't actually not that big given that they've sold Suarez and Sterling. But the thing I find confusing is his tactics. I mean, it almost seems to me like, you know, he uses this random tactics generator, and we go from 4-3-3, now we're back to 3 at the back, which wasn't working last year. I mean, is there any method to the madness, or?
I'm not sure. I think we saw last season that he was going through a bad spell and he went to the 3 at the back, and then all of a sudden it turned around. Part of me thinks that maybe he's doing the same this year, trying to use the same trick, going to 3 at the back, and that was 2 or 3 games ago, and that's there's been no difference in the results. They've got Villa coming up this weekend, followed by the away derby against Everton, and then followed by away against Tottenham. So if he doesn't get, I would say, at least 6 points from these next 3 matches, I think that's him done.
I mean, bearing in mind that they signed Villa's best player for a whopping $32 million in the summer, would a home defeat to Villa see him out of a job?
Well, Benteke is out injured now for the next 2 weeks, so that's one definite goal they would have got against Villa.
Is Sturridge fit enough to start? Or?
It looks like Sturridge will be starting this game. They're going to need Sturridge without Benteke.
I hope not, because I've sold him at 15 goals for the season. So,
but it's now a change of tactics he's going to need to use. Benteke is very much a front man, pacey, kind of holds the ball up well, very powerful. Sturridge is a bit more into the feet, a bit more technical. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the tactics this weekend, and I'm backing them to win this game against Villa, but I think come the Southampton match in a month's time, I think that'll be his last chance.
Okay, and Carlo Ancelotti apparently waiting in the wings. Now, Sunderland are another team with big problems, and they were absolutely hammered in the cup during the week by City, which, you know, not necessarily a priority for Sunderland. But I mean, given just how abject everything is there, I mean, is Advocaat gonna stay for the season? I mean, I was doing some research yesterday, and Sunderland, the last four seasons, Sunderland have finished the season with a different manager than they've started every year.
The club is rotten. I think it's a fairly well-known secret that it's a drinking club. There's a culture there where the guys are going out, getting drunk quite often at the weekends.
Rick, you're moving up to Sunderland now, are you?
Well, Newcastle, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, is that something you think is contributing, though?
Well,
I read something about that last year, I have to say.
That's partly the issue. There's a big scandal about Adam Johnson at the moment. I'm not too sure which way that's headed. But if you look at their core players, some of the key players, they've got the kind of British spine running through it, and it's the kind of old pros, ex-Man United players, guys that have nothing really to play for anymore. And I think that's one of the issues right now. There's no fresh blood in there, and there's no one really turning the game for them.
Yeah, definitely a lack of quality, and it sounds like Paolo Di Canio should have been banning more than just tomato ketchup. Now, Dr. Eva Carinero, I've never seen a club doctor in sport with so much attention around her. Now, she has left the club this week, and it looks like the whole thing will be going to court. I mean, I'm a Chelsea fan, and I have a huge man crush on Mourinho, I have to say, but I have to come down on her side on this. I don't know what you guys think. I mean, seems like a pretty, you know, pretty rough ride.
I just don't understand why it's actually going to go. Maybe it's just bluffing. Maybe it's like a divorce, but clearly, I think she's been hard done by, for better or for worse. She's going to have a base salary. She's going to have some sort of multiple year payout on the basis of that.
And it's also the damage done to her reputation. I mean, this has been very publicly... Yeah.
But, you know, in the scale of the mistakes that these big football clubs make, they should just come to an agreement, sort it out, and move on and get it out of the press, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, if you're willing to spend 30 million quid on a player who doesn't even play sometimes, then...
I guess that, you know, the Chelsea management have been backed into a corner here because it's, you know, it's Mourinho against her. So if they support her, it goes directly against the manager. But Rick, I mean, surely the job of the doctors at the side of the pitch, the physio, should be very, very much independent from the football side. I mean, they're not there to affect the tactics of a game. They're there to protect the welfare of the players, surely.
Yeah, to protect the welfare of the players and protect their careers. I mean, it's not just one game for the players. It's their whole entire career. So, obviously, the physiotherapists have that in mind. But I did hear that Newcastle are quite interested in her because they checked her speed sprinting across the field, and apparently it's faster than all their strikers.
Well, I think, having been up to Newcastle, I think they may be interested in her for different reasons. But anyway, now, Alex Ferguson has come out with some more comments from yet another book. I think this is his third book now. And I thought one of the things that was really interesting was that he came out and had ensured with the Glazers that there was a pay structure, which basically said that he would be paid as much as their highest paid player, which I think when he left was Wayne Rooney. I mean, how do we think about, you know, I mean, I think Mourinho's extremely well remunerated at Chelsea. I mean, is the manager really that important?
If he's that good, it's that important. Someone like Ferguson, someone like Mourinho, if you've got to pay them more than the footballers. I think they're the key person in the team, in the squad, and they make the big difference. And finishing one or two places up in the league is a big financial benefit for the club, so I think it makes sense.
But does it really, I mean, does it more depend on, for instance, the club structure? If you look at a club like, I was thinking Swansea, and I think maybe on the continent, Sevilla's maybe an example where the club is run in a very, very structured way. You have a scouting system and you have a transfer policy, and the coaches are effectively interchangeable. I mean, surely in those cases, you know, you wouldn't have that requirement. Is there maybe a lesson to be learned at somewhere like Manchester United if they're looking for continuity at maybe like the Swansea model? I mean, I know it's the two very different sizes of clubs, but...
I think in the case of Ferguson, I mean, he was there for 20 years and, you know, he built a massive legacy, and he was... He was very involved throughout all different levels of the club. Not just coaching the first team, but he was a big developer of the youth club. And, you know, he talked in his first book too, about his contract negotiations and how little he was paid. So I think, you know, after a 20-year tenure and the success he has a right to demand, you know, some kind of clause. But for other clubs, no, I don't think so. I think you're right. I think the managers can be more interchangeable. They have to establish some kind of, you know, longevity before they can start making demands.
Okay. Now, and one other point that Ferguson was happy to make was that in his entire time at Manchester United, he only managed four players that he classed as truly world-class, and that was Ryan Giggs, Paul Scholes, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Eric Cantona. Now, I love to have a go at Manchester United, I have to say, so I'm going to kick this off. For me, Ryan Giggs is not even close to being world-class. What he was able to do was keep up a level of constant mediocrity for 20 years. He discovered yoga at like 32, and so his hamstrings could actually manage. But I don't think I've ever seen Giggs play a game that was world-class. Consistent, yes, reliable, dependable, but surely not world-class. Guys?
As hard as it is to agree with you, I'm going to have to on this occasion. For me, watching Giggs, the most exciting player when he was 18, 19, 20, but the final ball was always the problem with him. He never had the final ball.
But even his corners, you can never get a corner past the first man.
Exactly, his delivery was not good. And then during the rest of his career, I think Ferguson kind of choked the excitement out of him. He became more of a by numbers player. And he was okay, not world class, but he was a top player though for me, and a great servant to the club,
a great professional, and a wonderful family man too. Now, Eric Cantona never did it in Europe. How can he be classed as well? I mean, a wonderful player to watch. We all love the swagger and the arrogance and, you know, the skill, but never did it in Europe.
Well, I think when you're talking about world-class with Cantona, it was because he had the ability to take a game by the scruff of his neck and make that game his own and get results. I mean, that is world-class in my sense. I mean, maybe he never did it for a long period of time. Maybe his world-class tenure was probably 2-3 years. But then he had all kinds of problems off the field and et cetera. But I think when he... in his prime, he was certainly world-class.
I think there was certainly one season, I was just going to say, with Cantona. I think it was the season they chased down Newcastle, and they had a series of 1-0s where I think Cantona was the winning goal. And
yeah, the 95-96 season where he scored the winning goal against Newcastle United.
It was a header, wasn't it, I think, wasn't it?
I can't remember what it was. It was, no, it wasn't. It was a volley against the ground into the far corner. And it was at Newcastle, and it was one of the key games that turned around the season for United. Manchester United, that is, and then that season he scored the winning goal in the FA Cup final against Liverpool, and that was the first double-double, I believe it was. So I think without him, history would have been very different, and perhaps some of the younger players that came through after that wouldn't have come through so much.
Also, his play at Leeds before he went to Man United was, he had some pretty good seasons there too.
Yeah, but he managed to get, while he was at Leeds, they managed to get knocked out of the European Cup by Rangers, I would add. So, again, the world-class debate will rumble on, but I think we've at least managed to put Giggs to one side. Now,
Giggs, it's just he never got to play in any tournaments for Wales.
Like I say, he's a very popular guy. But
He was the most liked footballer for Manchester United from other teams. In my opinion. Apart from
he had a long career.
He had
a lot of highlights in that career.
I would actually say my favorite player in the last 20 or 30 years for Manchester United is actually Massimo Taibbi. He was wonderful. Anyway, that takes us to the end of part one, and we'll be back with part two. And here we are back with part two of the One Shot Football Podcast. I'm your host, Steve McBain. You can get all your latest Premiership news at www.oneshotfootball.com. Now, in part two, we normally take time out to discuss a specific club or a topic. And today we're going to talk about something I wrote about on the website last week, which is basically football and the current loan system and the development of youth players. I mean, what do we think about the current youth system? Should the Premier League have a reserve division? Should there be limits on how many players can go out on loan? I mean, really, is is the best interests of young players and their development being served? I mean, guys, what do we think? It's a pretty open-ended question, I know.
I think it's a very difficult question to answer right now. I think when you were talking about Ferguson and how much managers should get paid, I think there's a very clear distinction between the top teams and the lower down teams, or even mid-level teams. The top teams have to have a certain way of scouring the whole football world for the young talent and bring them in as much as possible so that they're not going to lose out on anything in the future, you know, a big transfer fee in the future, for example. Now the mid-level teams, the lower-level teams have to scout players, bring players through to develop them for their first teams. So that's the big difference I see right now in the
so presumably you're talking about managers like maybe Dario Gradi at Crewe or Guy Roux at he was at Auxerre for a long time in France.
Exactly. The big teams are never going to have the success that Manchester United had in from the 92, going back even further, Celtic in 1960s.
Who?
Celtic in 1967. The Lisbon Lions. 14 out of the 15 players in that squad were born within 10 miles of Parkhead. It's never going to happen again. So you know, it's what is the youth system there for right now? That's a moving question for me. So that's the issue we need to discuss.
But when we're looking at this, I mean, where do we think? I mean, for instance, if you look at the Manchester United Academy, Manchester City have just spent a fortune on their new academy in buildings. Obviously Chelsea are, you know, trying to find a way to be self-sustainable. Do we think that the young players are better served by being there with presumably the best youth coaches and the best facilities, the best training, the best medical stuff, or do we think they're better off at a Crewe Alexandra or a...
I think if you look at what's happened with specifically with the Chelsea situation, with having players move out to Spain or moving up to the Netherlands or Belgium or whatever on loan and, you know, playing it few games here and a few games there, or a few seasons here and a few seasons there, it very much mirrors, and obviously I'm speaking from an American perspective here, what happens with baseball development in the US, where you have a whole minor league system and they play games and have development leagues, or the ice hockey system in the NHL, where you have minor league teams and you gradually move up. And I see the same thing with the Chelsea system specifically. They have players with potential who are younger. They want them to go out and get some games playing. They want them to have the chance of making it into the first team at some point, but they're not completely wedded to these players making it all the way to the system.
And Rick, I mean, surely the loan system is ensuring that these players are playing at a high level. I mean, one of the two players I drew a comparison with was Jack Wilshere and Theo Walcott. Now, Jack Wilshere, I mean, I know both of them had their careers stymied by injury, but I mean, Jack Wilshere had two seasons at, it was Bolton, I think, wasn't he? And, you know, was very, very successful. And I would say has developed, injuries aside, into a very good, very good young player. Whereas Theo Walcott, I think, he's a fraction of the player he could be. Yet he's been at Arsenal since he was 16. So there's a lot of criticism of the loan system and, you know, this, that, and the other.
I just don't think you can have a general system that's going to incorporate every individual player. Each player is different. Each player needs specific needs. I mean, look at Gascoigne. I mean, like, if he would have gone to Manchester United, he would have probably, under Ferguson, he probably would maybe not have gone so wild and crazy and been the greatest player of all time. Who knows?
Agreed.
But, you know, so I think, you know, it's not just about the football, too. It's about... because they're usually young people and they've got to learn about life and learn about professional football. They've got to learn how to deal with the media. They've got to learn how to deal with the lifestyle. So it's a bit more. So if you get
surely they'd be better served at the bigger clubs in that respect. I
mean, certainly, but when they get loaned out to overseas, to, you know, to European, you know, then they're dealing with different culture. Or when players are brought in from overseas, it's a different culture and they have to take that into the considerations too. So, you know, it's a bit of everything. I don't think it's as straightforward as just saying for football, yes, okay, but there's a lot more psychological factors that affect your football playing, you know, and being in the wrong environment can affect your mentality and affect your performance.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Manchester United, I was just thinking, I mean, you know, I mean, Ronaldo's probably not a very fair one to choose because he was just so good. You know, wherever he'd gone, he would have probably blossomed. But you know, as you say, as a 17-year-old Portuguese kid, it's not going to be easy living in Manchester.
No.
And if you look at, say, you know, Januzaj, I mean, he has, for me, got as much talent as I've seen in a young player in a long time, but yet he's just not, it's not happening for him at Manchester United.
But in a way, that sort of advocates the Chelsea system, whereas they have sort of a trusted relationship with a couple of European continental teams where they can send their younger players, and they know they're going to be taken care of in a reasonably attractive and comfortable way. They'll help them deal with the problems of living in a foreign country, rather than the random sort of loan system within the UK where... you could be at Newcastle, you could be at Sunderland, you could be at Bolton, you could be at, you know, West Brom, anywhere. And there isn't necessarily a structure there to deal with one of these lone players within the UK.
I think that's a very good point, because we're looking at the systems that teams play. Nowadays, teams have certain ways of playing, and Barcelona is a great example. All the youngsters are taught to play a certain way. So if you're Barcelona, you're not going to loan out a player to... I don't know, say Deportivo, who are playing a completely different style, you know, and I think that goes to the same for Chelsea, why they've done the agreements in Belgium, you know. It's very key that they do that, they follow that.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, one of the, I have a big sort of romance with Dutch football, and they seem to, for whatever reason, seem to be, they've stopped producing the players in the quantity that they were previously, and also the players that have been coming in from the Eredivisie haven't typically been doing well. But you know, if you look back at the old Ajax system, and they have the under nines play the same as the first team, and also PSV Eindhoven, PSV for a while were very, very successful because they were the guys that took over a very, very young Romario, who then from Brazil, who then went on to play, you know, obviously in Spain and became, you know, global superstar. And they also took over a very young Ronaldo. And you know, when Barcelona signed him, that was from PSV as well. So I mean, they seem to certainly for a while have a system that was working. They had the right amount of exposure to first team football. And I guess the problem with the loan system is you do get obviously the first team exposure, but you don't have a lot of control over how the player is being trained and how he's being developed. And that's maybe where, you know, where they're getting lost. I mean, one of the great sadnesses for me at Chelsea in the last few years has been Josh McEachran, who really looked like, you know, a proper deep line playmaker, looked like he'd all the tools, and it's just not happened. Now maybe he's just not good enough. But I just wonder whether if he'd stayed at Chelsea rather than being loaned out and loaned out and loaned out, he wouldn't have been lost to the system.
I think for me, Chelsea is an idiosyncratic situation because you've had to comply with FFP, and your system is based around making money out of the youth system,
as opposed to just loading the club with like $1 billion of debt. And
no, it doesn't matter. It's a perfectly valid way of doing it.
Americans, $15 million a year.
It's just a different way, so it's going to affect your youth team. So I think he's maybe suffered from that. I think,
but the youth team's been very successful. I mean, they're winning things at youth level,
but
right?
But you've got how many people in your youth team? And you're under 21s, you've got maybe 25 players. You've got 30 players out on loan for the... 32 players out on loan right now. And you've got around, is it 22 or 23 in the squad? So you've got about 70 players all challenging for the first team at the moment. So I think... having all those players challenged from the first team, it's going to create these times when certain players aren't going to perform that well, and they're going to go through the cracks, and they're not going to.
I mean, it may be with Chelsea that it's the culture of the club a little bit with Abramovich, where there's so much short-termism with the managers, where they feel so much pressure that they have to win this season. There's been umpteen different managers, whereas if you had a coach, and if I had one criticism of Mourinho is that it's his longevity. And B, his attitude to developing youth, which he just simply doesn't do. But if you had a long-term coach with this system, surely they would be leveraging on that. I mean, Loftus-Cheek, to me, looks like, you know, a really, really wonderful prospect. I mean, hopefully he will be one that will come through. But, you know, guys like Ryan Bertrand, I mean, you know, they spend so much money on that Felipe Luis. And I don't think he was any better than Ryan Bertrand, who's been playing well at Southampton.
But they're ultimately still within the system. And, you know, there's a chance a lot of these guys who've been farmed out to various overseas teams that they could come back in. I mean, you know, if you look at somebody like Ian Wright or something like that, who was picked up off of, you know, various, whatever, sub-professional team, yeah? he didn't blossom till late, and you're always reading stories about somebody who's kicked off the top of the youth squad at 14. And
well, I mean, even like a player like Diego Costa. I mean, yeah. if you do a quick Wikipedia on Diego Costa's career, I mean, he barely scored a goal until he was 24. Yeah. Didier Drogba was another who was rejected by several French clubs when he was younger. I mean, these things can happen, but I think, you know, that there is a real. There's a real problem, I think, with players from around about sort of 15 up to about 19, how they handle these guys and then sort of what they do. I mean, I would figure out if you're not good enough by 19, you're probably not going to be good enough in...
I'm not sure about that.
Well, you also have agents, right? And you have agents' interference. I mean, now, if you're 15 to 17, you're hot prospect talent, you can hire an agent.
I hate to say it, but especially with the case of a lot of the South American players, there's also a lot of parents getting rich off the back of that, and that's necessarily what's best for the player, right?
You also have to look at things at 19 years old. People develop very, very differently. I mean, I can remember my mathematics class, my algebra class when I was 15 years old, and there was a guy who was 6'3", 6'4", shaving every day, and was 215 pounds playing, and he went on to play for the Dallas Cowboys in American football. And you know what? I wasn't 6'3 or 6'4 until I was 22 or 23.
One of the most classic ones I can tell you with that is the Rangers signed Duncan Ferguson in about 1992 or 1993 for £4 million. And that was when £4 million was like a serious amount of money, especially for a transfer between Dundee United and Rangers. Now, Duncan Ferguson was rejected by Rangers at the age of, I think, 15 because he was too small. So, I mean, yeah, there you go. That backs up what you're saying about development. But at the same time, I mean, I think the ability of the players, should be identified. And I think there's clearly a massive failure within the English clubs in particular in their youth systems. I mean, there are very, very few players. I mean, the Manchester United system is vaunted as one of the most successful. But, I mean, how many young players have really come through and made the grade since the class of 92?
Probably about the same as Chelsea.
He loves to get a little dig in, doesn't he?
Let me think
of some more.
But you said that on last week's podcast with the Manchester United-Liverpool derby, and one of your questions was, how many local people in the derby? Zero.
Well, Manchester United reverted to taking the players from Liverpool, from the city, right, with Wayne Rooney. So.
But the amount of... These days, there's so much pressure on getting results that it's hard for the managers to bring these guys through. It's hard for them to give them a chance. And that's the issue with the top clubs like Chelsea, like Manchester United, who've brought a collective. I don't know, you've got Loftus-Cheek in the side now. United have a couple of players on the fringes, but the top clubs are not bringing these players through.
I think another question, I was just thinking about this before I had to phrase it, is if... say the Premier League teams all have these effectively development squads they're lending out to various clubs across Europe, whether it's Northern Spain or whether it's in the Netherlands, Belgium, whatever. Why aren't they lending them out to lower tier UK clubs? What's wrong with the lower tier UK clubs?
I think
Chelsea doesn't want to give their players out to them on loan.
Well, I mean, they have. I mean, Patrick Bamford's played in the Championship the last couple of seasons, but I think once you go down through the divisions, I think there's two things. One is that the football they play is completely non-representative of the football in the Premiership, and I think there's also a huge chance of injury. I mean, it's very, very physical down there.
I think it may also come down to the UK, and this is across all leagues, the schedule. There's just too many games and not enough actual opportunity to develop a player, which could be one of the fundamental problems.
I think as well as, I mean, it's possibly reflecting on wider society now that a lot of people have so many more choices these days. I mean, if you lived in certain areas, I mean, there's a lot of football clubs in the UK. I mean, you mentioned Celtic earlier, and obviously, Liverpool, and, they're associated with a very working class environment and background and location. So that this was, I guess, the way out for people. I mean, humans are much more transportable these days and have far more options.
Well, the managers are getting replaced so fast and quick too, right? I mean, so the manager comes in with a whole new system, a whole new tactics, and then they set up a youth program based on that, and then he's gone in 12 months.
But surely this is then advocating the Swansea system where there's a consistency from the club. This is our structure, this is our youth system, this is our transfer policy, and the coaches are just interchangeable.
Yes, that's...
Well, you may see like that Chelsea's like got that. Something very similar to that in reality over time. They've got effectively a structure, a youth policy now, with sending players out to various places in Europe. Maybe Mourinho is actually interchangeable.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, people were saying about Chelsea and Arsenal, but I mean, Arsenal have had the same manager for the last, you know, 20 seasons, and you know, in the last 10, 15 years, look how much Chelsea have won. I mean, it's a little bit similar to, you know, Chelsea are like a sort of mini Real Madrid in that respect, and that there's, you know, there's an authority at the top, and the, you know, the best players are bought where it's possible, and the managers come and go.
But going back to your point about restrictions on loans, should we restrict the loans? Should Chelsea be restricted in the amount of loans they have people have going out at the moment? They've got 32 out right now, I believe.
I have to say, I think the problem a lot of this is EU law and what's anti-competitive and the whole thing, but I would, for me, yeah, I mean, I don't know what the number would be, 10, 15, 20, whatever it may be, but I would think that a lower number would be, I think would be more effective at making sure that the talent is spread out and has a, you know, more of an equal chance to rise. I mean, when Parma went bankrupt or whatever happened to Parma last year, I mean, they went down a couple of divisions. I think they had more than 100 professional players on their books. I mean, it was...
But a lot of those were part-owned, I believe. There was kind of a lot of sharing of...
Part-ownership's yeah. another...
But, I mean, with Chelsea, they've developed this model which works. Chelsea are now sustainable. Through their youth system, selling players on for $2-4 million, it's making them
you look at the way they handled Courtois. I mean, they signed him for 10 or 12 million, loaned him out for three seasons, where he developed into one of the best young keepers in the world, played in Champions League finals, won La Liga, and paid for his transfer fee. I mean, okay, not everyone's a success story, but that's a perfect example of.
And then they sold on check afterwards. Bit of money too, so it's a successful business model. Maybe it's not what everybody aspires to.
Well,
in football.
Is it morally or ethically right? Which is another debate where we kind of, whose interests are we looking for? Is it the club or is it the player? So it's.
But at the same time, if UEFA put in these FFP rules, which okay, I mean, I'm not actually sure whether FFP exists anymore. I really am so confused this season. But by putting in the FFP rules, I mean, they effectively force clubs' hands, and you know, they've responded by...
I admire Chelsea for doing what they've done. They've found a solution to this issue, you know, and Man City haven't. Man City, all they did was sold the rights for their stadium and their training grounds for tens of millions of pounds, and that's how they got Man City.
Do Manchester City have anyone coming through, or...? They had this young guy that scored, he was on loan at Celtic last season, I can't remember his name, but the guy that scored the winner at Palace. But apart from that, I mean, there's been very little...
They've got a couple of young chaps coming through. Their name is... I forget their name, so...
Seems their method of development is just going out and buying the best player available.
Yeah, the best five players in that position available.
Yeah.
When I was living in London, there was Chelsea football in the community, which, you know, every term break and everything like that, they had all the kids over Battersea Park, all around central London, or sort of south central London. And it was 5 days, and it was very... good value, frankly. I had all the kids going. It's, you know, 5 hours a day during term, and it was drills and then penalties at the end of the day and mini games, and it was great. And that was really good. And that's, you know, ultimately they're trying to find these young players, and the system I think works.
I think the problem is that, you know, just too many of these players are simply not quite good enough. I mean, John Terry was a regular in the Chelsea team as a teenager. I remember having very, very high hopes for the likes of Jody Morris, John Harley, Carlton Cole, but you know, ultimately, if you look at their careers, you know, they petered out and they weren't good enough.
But is that? I mean, I don't think what's up for debate is their skill. The skill level is there for all of these players. It's what's going on mentally, and that's the big difference between the top players and the guys that just are there and thereabouts. You know, the Franny Jeffers, the Jody Morrises. You know, that's they weren't there mentally, and that's.
Or maybe if they were better looked after, or looked after more properly.
Or perhaps if they went to a second division team where they had to fend for themselves and become men, essentially, it could have improved their long term careers.
Okay.
I don't want to barge in here, but I'm just thinking back to our Ryan Giggs question. Why did he last so long, even though the three of you don't particularly like him? And I'm.
Oh, hang on.
I don't dislike him. It's his brother that dislikes
rugby,
him.
My understanding is I believe his father was a fairly high standard rugby player, and he played rugby to a fairly high standard himself until 12, 14 or something like that. Maybe my dates are wrong. But I was interesting. I was reading something that was probably about a month ago, and I remember it saying that actually one of the best ways to develop athletes who do well over the longer term, that's avoiding injury, is to make sure that they're exposed to a whole series of sports. So not just football, 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 football from age or 6 years old, but, you know, maybe they're doing football and rugby. Maybe, you know, Wayne Rooney doing football and boxing, frankly, which is a very different
sport. I don't know if the boxing is doing Wayne Rooney
any good. He was doing a mix of things. So, you know, maybe the system...
I don't know if you've seen YouTube over the last year, but...
Anyway, maybe the system that just takes somebody and hothouses them only in football is actually leading to its own demise. And what you need is people who do, you know, a variety of things for a certain period of time and then...
But Ryan Giggs, look what he... Look, I mean, okay... World class or not, okay, but look what he did. He, you know, he changed the way professional football players look at their profession. I mean, he's the ultimate look after himself, fit, disciplined, you know, ultimate professional. Takes everything very seriously. Off season, he's training hard, and his longevity and his records prove that. I mean, and that's a great example to set for any young person developing.
Okay, well, it's a debate that will rumble on, but hopefully we've stoked your fires and given you food for thought. That takes us to the end of part two, and we'll be back with part three. So here we are back with part three of the One Shot Football podcast. You can get all your football news at www.oneshotfootball.com. So we're just going to have a look in part three at the. Some of the bigger or the more interesting games this weekend. So we're going to kick off with Spurs and Manchester City. I mean, Spurs, okay, they've turned the corner possibly, but they badly need another win. They need to climb the table. And City, obviously, they had a terrible result at home to West Ham, and they badly needed 3 points as well. So this is a pretty crunch game, guys.
Yeah, it is. I think... Spurs have got a bit of a chance here. It looks like Kompany and Silva are both out this for this match, and Mangala might be a doubt. So
I think Mangala being a doubt is probably a good thing, no?
Perhaps. And I think the performance from Song and Dele Alli in the past few matches have been very positive for Spurs, and even Lamela is starting to turn the corner. Hopefully, he's a great player.
Spurs' new Korean signer looks pretty good, no?
Yeah, he looks great. He's got all the attributes. He can dribble, he can shoot, he can pass. He's got great range of passing.
And he can sell a lot of shirts, I'm sure, as well.
So. He can certainly do that. I've still got this down as an away win for Man City, 3-1. But I think Spurs won't be too far away if all their top players play this weekend.
Okay, should be a cracking match now. Arsenal have to travel to the King Power Stadium to take on high-flying Leicester. I think Leicester are probably the surprise team of the season. If you took the table from 1st of April, and this is no April Fool, Leicester would be top. So, I mean, can they stick another pin in the Arsenal balloon? I mean, Arsenal obviously were trounced by Chelsea last week, but they'll be looking to come back. They've got Europe to think about again. They need to rotate. What are we thinking here, guys?
I think Arsenal, to be honest, we'll see how it goes. Maybe it's an away draw, but I think Arsenal want to bounce back, you know, from the loss for whatever reasons, whatever your complaints are to Chelsea. Admittedly, Leicester's doing well, but they won't be going into Leicester not knowing that Leicester's a good side. So they'll be going in there, they'll be well organized. I think they'll be on the rebound from an unfortunate loss as far as they're concerned to Chelsea. I think score draw away or Arsenal wins.
Yeah, I've got to agree with you. I think Arsenal all over for me on this one.
Rick, any differing opinions? Or?
Leicester are playing really well. I mean, they're a come from behind team, and they have great belief, and they're really surprising this season. But if you watch the football they're playing very well. I go with a draw on this.
Okay, I'm going to take Leicester to win this, just to be controversial.
Just because you love Arsenal.
Absolutely,
so much.
Now, Southampton versus Swansea. These are two, I think, really interesting clubs, and I think they're two clubs that I think generally neutrals and people without an axe to grind want to see do well. I mean, you know, Southampton really flirted with some real success last season, and Swansea are just a blueprint for success. It's a little bit hard to gauge these guys this season. They've been inconsistent. Southampton, I think, have had the heart ripped out of them with Alderweireld the chap that went to Manchester United, Schneiderlin, and obviously Nathaniel Clyne. I think that has hurt them. But, I mean, I think this should be, you know, an interesting fixture and a good game, a good, you know, attractive game of football. I mean, is either of these two clubs going to make a statement here, or?
This is a tough one to call. Very tough one to call. The past three encounters, the away team has won 1-0 on each occasion. I'm going to go against that this time. I think Southampton have got enough to beat the Swans.
I mean, Southampton have only got one win in the last six. I mean, it's not great form.
True, but Swansea have not looked. They've not scored a goal since.
Swansea have only got two in six.
Since they scored against United, that's the last goal they scored, and that's three games ago.
And United, of course, these days are easy meat. So, so what are we going for here?
I'm picking another manager. I like Koeman.
You like Koeman, okay, so you're going for Southampton?
I don't like Koeman, but I'm going for them as well. I've got a 2-1 home win.
I got Southampton on this one. I think they're playing much better, and I don't really like Swansea because they're a thorn in my side.
I have to say, I think that Southampton may start to pick up from here. I'll probably lean towards a home win as well. Now, I think Stoke were a team that I was really excited about at the start of the season. Now they're at home to Bournemouth. I mean Hughes is really trying to change the philosophy here, but you know, the truth is that they're down at the bottom of the table. You know, they're in the relegation zone. I mean, if they were to lose at home to Bournemouth, who are, you know, definitely relegation candidates, I mean, is this Hughes starting to be under pressure, or?
I think certainly if he doesn't win, he's going to start to get under pressure. I mean, Stoke, you know, traditionally very strong at home, and you know, if they start losing home games, I think Hughes is definitely on the chopping block.
I think I've used this analogy in the last couple of weeks, and I'll keep using it because I think it's a good one. I mean, you know, with Stoke, it's a bit like if you saw Meg Ryan, you know, 10, 15 years ago, she looked really good. Now she's gone through a lot of cosmetic surgery, and the results are really, really not good. And I look at Stoke and, you know, they've really had that. What made them such an effective team? I mean, okay, I know it was pretty agricultural. You know, there wasn't anything too sophisticated about it, but it did work. And has Hughes maybe tried to change too much at once, or?
I kind of like your analogy. I think it's kind of almost opposite because they've gone from ugly to playing well, attractive football. So, I think he's changed a lot. I think he's changed perhaps a little bit too much. But I like the fact that they've changed it. I like the fact that they're trying to play football. They've got some great players in there. Shaqiri, Bojan. I think they've got a fantastic potential there.
Five Champions League winners in their squad.
Exactly.
I don't know. I mean, as I was saying before, my parents are from Crewe. And obviously Stoke is just down the road. And I've been down there a few times. That's where you go to get your new windows done or something like that. And I actually quite like the fact that that was the hard place to go with the hard team in the rainy, grim weather in the middle of the winter. You know, it was a real test for the better sides in the Premier League to go there. You know, Arsenal going in February or Chelsea.
Well, Bournemouth are presumably soft southerners. You know, it's a retirement village on the south coast.
Prove the point that you could win in the grim weather. I don't like the way it's gone.
Yeah, can Messi do it on a cold afternoon or evening in Stoke? I don't know. We still don't know yet.
Yeah.
So, what are we going for here, guys? I mean, can Stoke turn the corner or more trouble for Hughes?
Yeah, I'm taking Stoke on this one. 2-1. Stoke 2-1.
Stoke 2-1 for you, Rick?
For me, the manager is the key thing here. Yeah. Eddie Howe is a better manager than Mark Hughes.
And, it's a big call.
It's a 2-1 away win for me.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go for Stoke losing. Yeah. Because I'm not particularly a fan of Hughes, to be honest. He bounces around a bit, and I understand what he's trying to do, but I think, you know, philosophically, maybe Stoke's better off sticking with the hard team in the mud.
Okay, well, I'm going to recall Hughes' Halicon days at Chelsea, and I'll go for a home win.
Chelsea, okay.
Now, Newcastle-Chelsea. This is actually a very, very interesting game, because these are two managers who are still under huge pressure. I mean, obviously, Mourinho... They've had three wins in the last three games, but another poor result here, and you know, Chelsea are still in the bottom half of the table, and Newcastle cannot buy a win. I mean, they were abject again during the week. They got beat by Sheffield Wednesday. I mean, could McLaren out of a job if Newcastle lose again?
I think the management situation at Newcastle is very different to other teams. I think there's no chance that McLaren will be losing his job until at least halfway through the season. Mike Ashley is not the sort of person that's going to sack someone for coming down at the bottom of the. You know, they're gonna be doing okay because their team is they've got a decent team there.
But I mean, the league form is played 6, lost 4, drawn 2.
True. But I think the squad they've got there, I think he's going to give them time to turn it around until at least the transfer window in January. There's no way that he's going to sack him right now. But saying that, this fixture right now, it's a bit of a bad fixture for Chelsea. They've lost.
Well, interestingly, Jose Mourinho has never won at St James's.
Right? And honestly, if he loses up there against a weak side, basically, in the current situation.
Chelsea are 15th.
I think he comes under pressure if they lose away.
An interesting game. So, I mean,
more pressure,
presumably
yeah.
The Manchester United fans are going for home wins here, are they?
No way. Chelsea's too good. Chelsea's had a very rough start to the season, but they're starting to get a lot more structure. They're just too much quality for Newcastle at this time. And it's unfortunate because Newcastle play with passion and they'll be tough to beat.
So,
but
home
Chelsea,
win for you? That's
Chelsea,
sorry, away win for you, sorry?
Away
win?
Yeah, Chelsea all day for me.
Away win, I'll go for
it. Well, I'm nervous now because I personally think that Chelsea's problem this year has been their pre-season. They experimented with something and it didn't work, and I think they're catching their stride now. But the fact that you guys have all gone for an away win makes me nervous. So I'll just go for a draw. Now then, just to finish things off, we're going to go to a weekly quiz, and we discussed Diego Costa earlier, so we're going to have a quiz on bad boys. So, starting off, guys, Luis Suarez. After being sent off in the World Cup semi-final in 2010, how many times has Luis Suarez subsequently been sent off?
Three
from Rick.
Yeah, in 2010.
Since 2010. Come on, guys, silence is terrible on the radio. It's 5 years, guys.
Five years?
No idea.
Six times.
The answer is a big fat zero. Yeah. But in that time, despite never being sent off, how many games has he been banned for?
He's
for violent behavior.
So what is the total number of bans that Suarez has endured?
10 games.
10 games, you reckon?
I think it's over 30. I've got a feeling.
Whoa! I really have no idea. How can he have violent? How can he?
Rick,
not be
you are undershooting massively.
Really? Is that a few biting incidents?
Biting, racial slurs.
Do I, you
slurs.
30?
Yeah.
Is this 30 your final?
I'm around 30.
Actually, yeah.
30?
Set out for
25.
Okay, the answer is 45 games. Seven matches for biting whilst at Ajax.
Yeah.
8 games for racially abusing
was
Patrice Evra.
2010, though?
Nope. 10 games for biting Branislav Ivanovic.
Yeah.
And 11 games for the Chiellini bite. Which also included 9 international
and the
games.
The racial slur forever.
Yeah,
right?
So that was 45 games despite never being sent off. That's pretty impressive, I'd have to say. Now, Eric Cantona, who famously attacked a fan at Crystal Palace. By the way, true or false, your host today was sitting in the stand opposite with a perfect view of Cantona's attack.
I'm pretty sure that's true.
Why would you go to Palace
Man
United?
True or false?
False. I think you were the fan.
Certainly was not, but that's the next question. True or false?
True.
True, it is true. I was there, yeah. Now, what was the name of the fan? The most famous Crystal Palace fan of all time?
Steve?
No. It's Matthew Simmons.
Matthew
right?
Simmons, correct. Now, how long was Cantona's ban for?
It was, I think it was 9 months.
8 months, but pretty close. Now, what was the criminal sentence in the High Court that Cantona incurred?
Assault.
Simple assault.
But he was...
But the sentence.
It was community service.
I thought he got off.
Specifically?
Sentence, community service, training kids to play football.
It was actually 2 weeks in jail, which was then commuted to 120 hours in community service. I listened to actually a really fascinating interview with Manchester United's head of security, who was looking after Cantona at that point. It's really worth listening to. Now
he was absolutely devastated by it.
Yeah. I mean, Ferguson had to work really hard to get him to come back. Now then, Joey Barton allegedly abused the PSG Brazilian defender Thiago Silva, the Brazilian captain, by calling him what? Allegedly, are we
allowed to say?
Are we allowed to swear on this?
You're not allowed to swear, no.
No, this has passed me by, this one.
He referred to him as an overweight ladyboy. Now then, I don't know how that translates into French.
Well, I would have kicked him in the back of the knee for that.
We need to subscribe to Twitter.
Now, who were Sheffield Wednesday playing when Paolo Di Canio pushed over a referee? Guys?
For some reason in my mind it's West Ham, but I...
West Ham?
West Ham seems logical to me, but yeah, I don't know.
They did buy him, but no, it was Arsenal. And can you name the ref?
Wenger.
It was one of the worst falls ever. Because he kind of had this like little sort of stagger steps, and then kind of it was a terrible fall.
Well, Mike Dean is the one from this past week, right?
I think he would have actually been booked for diving if he wasn't the ref. No advance on Paul Alcock.
Okay.
And how long was Di Canio banned for?
Was that about 9 games?
9's your answer?
9 games?
6, I don't really know.
11. 11 was the answer.
Why is the 11?
And now,
because the referee.
If you have any memory of the incident, can you remember which Arsenal player initially squared up to Di Canio, and then when Di Canio turned on him very, very quietly, got very timid and ran behind, I think it was Martin Keown.
Martin, yeah.
You can remember who the Arsenal player was? Nigel Winterburn, who ended up at West Ham also. Now, Malky Mackay... created some controversy whilst he was at Cardiff, and with some alleged racist SMSs sent about his employers. But his LMA representative described the SMSs as...
Banter?
Nearly.
Sure,
one more word.
Innocent, silly banter?
Friendly banter. Now, Ronaldinho, I have to say, is one of my favourite players of all time. Now, in 2014, he released a rap song. Can anyone tell me what it's called?
No.
And no checking the internet, Mike.
No, I have to tell
you. Okay, I'll put you all out of your misery. It's called Let's Drink. Now, let me just give you a little sample of the lyrics here. Boot the glass up high, let's drink. We will enjoy life, we drink. I'm full of money, let's drink. Now, bearing in mind he recorded this in spring of 2014, just ahead of the World Cup in Brazil, I think it's safe to say he wasn't expecting a call up to the squad. Now, in March 2014, Alan Pardew earned a red card for...
strangling a player, wasn't it?
No. Nope. That was the Leicester manager last year.
Headbutting.
He headbutted David Miller from
correct. Yeah. Strangling, headbutting.
Yeah, that was quite incredibly stupid.
Now, your final question is on Roy Keane. He was quoted as saying, "There are things I regret in life, and he's not one of them." Who was he referring to?
Alex Ferguson.
No. Alfie Inge Haaland.
Alfie Inge Haaland, that famous career-ending tackle.
And I don't think I can repeat what Keane said to him.
Yeah, I looked at that and I had to leave that out. This is a family show after all. And how long was the ban?
I have no idea. It should have been 6 months or a year, but it was...
It was games. Can we have a guess?
Three games
here?
Well, if it's three and then you give Costa three for playing handbag, that's absurd. But
let's give it 6 games.
Three, six. It was a total of 8 games. Well, I think the guys have done very poorly in the quiz, but there you go. Doesn't really matter, does it? Now, that takes us to the end of today's One Shot Football podcast. So my thanks to my fellow guests, Chris, Mike, and Rick. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for having us.
I'm your host, Steve McBain, and hopefully we'll hear from you again next week. Thank you, guys.